Thanks for joining us for another edition of On the Block Radio, the show that takes a critical look at the criminal justice system. On tonight's show, we will speak with Seattle activist Fern Renville about John T. Williams, a Native American woodcarver who was killed on August 30th, 2010 by a police officer. He was homeless and deaf, and many believe another victim of police brutality. Then we will talk with Brandy Fisher of the Alliance for Police Accountability about Jordan Miles, who on January 12, 2010, was beaten up by police as he walked to his grandmother's house. Over the course of the attack, he was repeatedly punched in the face, hit with a tree branch, and patches of his neat locks were pulled from his hair, according to Brandy Fisher of the Justice for Jordan Miles campaign and the Alliance for Police Accountability. He was subsequently charged with 2 counts of aggravated assault, loitering and prowling at nighttime, escape and resisting arrest. Although all charges were eventually thrown out, his face was badly swollen, he deals with permanent nerve damage, and according to Brandy Fisher, he still struggles emotionally as a result of what happened that night. Those stories coming up on this extended edition of On the Block Radio. August 30th, 2010, John T. Williams was shot and killed as he walked down a Seattle street. He was a well-known woodcarver in the Seattle area, and minutes before he was killed, he was holding a knife that was 3 inches long, less than the minimum length that a knife needs to be considered illegal to carry in public. He was 50 years old, a Native American, homeless, deaf, and many believe a fatality of police brutality. Aspects of the incident were captured by a police car video camera. On that videotape is heard shots being fired only 4 seconds after Williams was directed to drop the knife he was carrying. And according to Fern Renville, a community member actively involved in making sure that the police are held accountable in this case, a coroner's report states that Williams appears to have been shot from the side, not from the front, as one would have expected if he was lunging towards the officer with a knife. We're talking with Fern Renville, who is working with a group of others in the Seattle area to bring justice to the family of John T. Williams. John T. Williams, on August 30th, was killed by a police officer, Ian Burke. And coming up on January 10th will be an inquest surrounding this case. John Williams was a Native American who was a woodcarver, well-known in the Seattle area for being a woodcarver, and he was shot by a police officer. Many believed it was an unjustified shooting. And Fern Renville, who is herself a Native American, she is a member of the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate tribe and also the managing director of Red Eagle Soaring Native Youth Theater. How you doing, Fern?
I'm doing just fine, thank you.
I was wondering if you can go ahead and tell us a little bit more about the case, and I'd also like to know about your own personal relationship with John Williams.
I worked at the Seattle Public Library downtown when I first moved to Seattle a few years ago, and like a lot of libraries in big cities, it serves as a sort of day room for the homeless, and I happened to meet John T. Williams there, and I certainly wasn't a close friend, or not really even a friend, but I got to know him and was struck by what a sweet guy he was, and I would see him around town frequently. He was a real fixture in downtown. I'd go so far as to call him an icon. Everyone knew John, and he and his family have sold carvings to tourists, last 3 generations at Victor Steinbrück Park, which is the little park that's right next to Pike Place Market. So he is a real fixture, and that is how I met him. So I didn't know him well, but he was a person whose kindness and talent I respected.
And what happened on August 30th?
On August 30th, he was hanging out with his two brothers at Victor Steinbeck Park at Pike Place Market, and then he decided to walk up to Capitol Hill, and he was on his way there and was crossing a street and holding a piece of wood and his 3-inch carving pocket knife, which, by the way, is legal in Seattle. It's legal to carry a 3-inch pocket knife. And he was walking across the street when a 27-year-old, 2-year police officer, he's been on the force for 2 years, and he's also, I understand he's a vet of either Afghanistan or Iraq, I can't remember which, but was stopped, and this young police officer, within less than 60 seconds of getting out of his car and shouting at John to drop the knife, he shot John. And probably everyone is familiar with this incident because the video has been circulating widely online. And
I wanted to ask you, the video from who?
So the all of the police vehicles in Seattle have cameras on the car that are automatically activated when the officer gets out. And this camera was activated when Officer Burke stepped out of his vehicle. And so this incident is on video, and it was just released fairly recently, so you can Google it and go online and watch. It's hard to watch, though.
One of the things that I was reading in one of the articles was that that very video, that same video, actually, you can't really see the shooting, but you can hear the audio of what was taking place, and that you can hear that the officer, only 4 seconds after issuing the first of 3 rapid commands, start shooting. Is that what you've heard as well?
Yes. It was 4 seconds, and that's you can hear it and very clearly what's going on. John T. Williams was deaf in one of his ears. So if he did hear the officer shouting at him from behind, that's unclear whether he heard it. And also, the officer did not identify himself as a police officer. And I don't know about you, but when I'm walking, and this is kind of a gritty urban neighborhood that John was walking in, when I walk in certain neighborhoods in the city, if I hear somebody shouting at me, I typically don't turn around or pay any attention. I'm always like just trying to keep my head down and keep walking to avoid any sort of conflict. But
so this officer was in a I'm sorry, say that again.
It was 4 seconds from the time Officer Burke shouted at John and when he shot him.
And so this officer was not in plain clothes. He was in his uniform, and he had a marked car. It's just that he was coming at him from behind.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Now, that's interesting because it's not as if it's not the same situation as if he was lunging towards him and that his life was in grave danger. He was walking behind John Williams, and he didn't stop. Or he didn't, would he ask him to stop or ask him to put the knife down? What was it?
He asked him to drop the knife. Mm-hmm. And the knife itself is a knife with a safety mechanism that locks the blade closed when it's in the closed position and also locks it open. And I have the exact same knife myself that I carry in my bag because I'm a gardener and I use it for plant cuttings and whatnot. But it's almost impossible and the various various expert witnesses have stated that it would be virtually impossible for the knife to close on its own. But when the police arrived on the scene and the police photographer took a picture, the knife was closed on the ground. So John had closed it, and it's likely that when he heard the officer shouting at him, he closed it, which would contradict the officer's first statement that he made to the press, which was that John T. was lunging at him with the open knife and he feared for his life. Mm-hmm. The story changed within just a few days, and the lunging part was removed. Mm-hmm. So, the police spokesperson who made the first statement to the press about this put forth that falsehood about John T. lunging. And that also contradicts the witness testimony from the folks that were around. It was actually close to rush hour in a busy neighborhood, so there were lots of people coming and going, and actually it was lucky that no one else was shot because that could have easily happened.
Mm. Now, the forensic evidence shows that the gunfire came from behind John?
The coroner's results show that John T. was shot from the side, which also, once again, contradicts the officer's testimony about John T. lunging. John T. was not facing Officer Burke when he was shot.
Mm-hmm. And what about what can we make of the account that the police gave, or I think it was witnesses, of afterwards, what happened afterwards, Burke reporting to other officers what had occurred, and he was pointing out the knife to or the hand where the knife was held to other officers, and he had his foot on the knife. What can we make of that? What's that about?
Wow, I didn't hear that detail, so I can't speak to that. Mm-hmm. I do know that the first version he gave was different than the version he gave about an hour later, which was after the Police Guild lawyers had talked to him. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the language of the statement that he gave seems like lawyer's language. It didn't seem even like the language that would come out of the mouth of a policeman. It sounded like something the lawyers told him to say. Mm-hmm. But I didn't hear that part about his foot on the knife. I did listen to the audio after the shooting. There's probably, I can't remember, maybe 14 minutes of audio captured, and there's, you know, one officer saying to Burke, "You did a good job, you did the right thing." But I didn't know about that part.
Mm. Okay, all right. I'm curious about what's going on next. I think it's I don't know if it's something that's unique in the United States, but I haven't heard of anything like this before. It's a process that you said happens automatically whenever a police officer shoots a civilian or maybe shoots anybody, that there has to be some kind of an investigation. And there is there needs to be an investigation first by the Firearm Review Board?
The Firearms Review Board is a department that's internal to the Seattle Police Department. It looks at officer-related shootings and determines whether they're justified or unjustified. And in this case, the shooting of John T. Williams was found to be unjustified, which led to the next step of the inquest, which is starting Monday, and which once more is not a process that's going to determine criminal liability. It's simply a fact-finding mission that then gives the King County prosecutor the information that he needs to determine whether to file criminal charges against Officer Burke. And if you look at the history of inquests following officer-related shootings in Washington State, I believe there has not been criminal charges filed against an officer since 1970. So it's really very unlikely, in my opinion, that criminal charges will be filed against Officer Burke. There is just a huge... The decks are stacked so in the favor of police. It's really hard to see how this could lead to criminal charges against Ian Burke. Although you never know, it's possible that that enough public outcry would cause the prosecutor to. I don't know how much discretion he has, but I'm assuming he has some.
Are you aware of whether or not that this whole process, that includes an investigation soon after there's an officer related shooting, and also whether there's video in or the ability for vehicles, cop cars, to capture on video any kind of activity that their officers are engaged in. Are you aware of those things taking place in other parts of the country?
The use of camera technology in policing apparently is a trend that is growing. I understand that the Oakland Police Department now has every beat cop wearing a body camera that records video and audio for his or her entire shift. And that is a trend which I believe will only continue, and which I believe is a piece of helping police departments to be accountable. Mm-hmm. I think we all behave a little better when we know we're being watched. Mm-hmm. It's certainly not a panacea. I mean, there was a camera on Officer Burke's car, and he still went ahead and shot John T. So mm-hmm. clearly it's not going to stop mm-hmm. Officer misconduct altogether, but it's possible that it will help.
And what about the automatic review process that takes place after an officer shoots someone?
So the Firearms Review Board is an internal department. So your first step in an officer-related shooting is basically having the department investigate itself. So make of that what you will. There's no real civilian review or civilian oversight of the Seattle Police Department. The Office of Professional Accountability is the office which investigates officer misconduct and basically any complaints against the police department. And it is run by a civilian who is an appointee of the mayor, but she's one person, and the staff that she oversees are police staff. And my understanding is that they're rotating staff sergeants, and so you're asking people to investigate their own colleagues. Mm-hmm. And that's not true civilian oversight. Mm-hmm. So going into the inquest, the Native community does not have a huge amount of faith that criminal charges will be filed against Ian Burke, but we're starting to look at joining forces with other communities of color in Seattle to bring about some reform to that oversight and inquest process to modernize it and make it more accountable. Mm.
Okay. And I'm wondering, do you think, and have you heard other people making comments about the connection between, if there is, whether or not there is a connection between the fact that that Burke was a vet of, was
African? Speculation about whether he had some sort of stress disorder, and if you watch the video and you do, I mean, it seems like he was almost, I don't know, it's hard to speculate, but did John T. Williams get shot because Ian Burke thought he was ignoring him, or it seems like such a clearly over-the-top reaction that I can't help thinking that something was going on with Officer Burke. It was an extreme reaction to the circumstances. There's been a lot of speculation about whether that played a part in it, and I don't know what kind of screening is in place in the Seattle Police Department for that is specific for to vets, screening that would help find out if a person does have some sort of stress disorder. Mm-hmm. I know that the police department does have all sorts of access to therapists and whatnot, but I'm not sure if they actually use those services. Mm-hmm. I don't know at what rate officers access those services.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what has happened since John Williams's killing to the family? One thing I remember you speaking to me about before was some acts of intimidation against his brother, Rick Williams.
Yes. The community organized a candlelight vigil for the family right after John T's death, and it took place outside the Chief Seattle Club, which is a day center for homeless natives in downtown Seattle. And his family came, and I happened to meet Rick Williams, John T's brother, that evening, and I had never met him before. Rick called me a few weeks later in October to ask for my help setting up a website for him to sell carvings, and I agreed to meet him at Victor Steinberg Park at Pike Place Market to discuss that, and I stopped in about 3 o'clock on an afternoon in October, on October 21st, and I went and sat down on the bench at Victor Steinberg. It's this bench where all the native carvers have sat for generations and carved right there in public, and they sell their work to tourists and to shops around the area. In any case, I sat down and I started, I had a little notebook, and I was interviewing Rick and asking him, questions about what his needs were as far as starting a website. And probably 20 minutes in, I just noticed, it was like the third or fourth police cruiser in as many minutes that was just slowly cruising by in front of the bench. And I looked around and was just struck by how many police were present that day around the market. And I said, what's going on with all the police here? And Rick said, we've never experienced this kind of police presence here. And they're intimidating us and trying to harass us, and they keep trying to engage me in conversations that I don't want to be in, under the guise of offering condolences. And I was completely shocked because the police department has received such scrutiny. It just seemed unbelievable that the beat officers on the street would be harassing the Williams family openly. So I had my phone with me, which has a camera in it, and he said, like, those folks, and he nudged me, and I turned around, and there were two bicycle cops across the street, and they were just kind of standing on the edge of the curb with their arms folded over their chests, watching us. And then one of them took out his camera and started taking photographs. And at that point, I decided to walk across the street and ask why they were doing that. And I walked across the street, and I had my camera open, my phone, and I was my intention to take their photographs and get their badge numbers. And the first words out of this police officer's mouth involved the F word. And I said, oh, excuse me, are you on duty? And he said, does it look like I'm on duty? And he had this sneering, belligerent tone. And I said, well, I didn't know officers on duty used profanities with the public. And then he said, can you prove that I did? And at that point, I realized that, you know, it was just things were getting tense. So I took their photographs and their badge numbers. Rick Williams had followed me across the street, and at that point they sort of shifted their attention to him, and they started berating him, and he had one of his teenage sons with him. He has three teenage boys, and the cops started provoking the boy and harassing him and being really inappropriate, and not to mention incredibly insensitive. You would think that if the police force has just killed this family's uncle and brother, and they didn't have the grace to leave his family alone. In any case, when that sort of incident sort of when the two officers, they after they were finished with his son, we all came and sat back down on the bench, and then two more bike cops came cruising up and came and parked themselves sort of at the end of the bench, and then the two from across the street came back over, and so I took their photographs because it was clearly, you know, like they were just going to be right there in our faces. And when I took their picture, they surrounded me and they were laughing at me, and they all took my photograph, and they were invading my personal boundaries and putting their faces up really close and being intimidating and just and being belligerent and provocative. And it was funny because I just a couple days before had been at this Native Advisory Council meeting in which the brass who were there trying to placate the Native audience were talking about how important the de-escalation training is that all the officers take. And this was the farthest thing from de-escalation. It was just pure provocation. And so I have family members who are in law enforcement, and I've never been treated disrespectfully by police officers. So that was a completely new experience for me, and the officers seemed, they didn't seem nervous at all about their behavior. It didn't seem to me like they were at all afraid to behave that way. And I'm thinking it was because I was sitting on a bench and talking to Rick Williams, that there's that kind of double standard where they feel they feel entitled to treat street natives that way.
You said street native, so you think it had a lot to do with him being homeless, but also being Native American.
Absolutely. So working at the library in downtown Seattle, I, you know, heard lots of stories from street natives about, and not just street natives, but homeless people, about harassment at the hands of police. And the Chief Seattle Club, which works with homeless Native clients, they hear stories all the time, and really any Native person who spends a lot of time on the street in Seattle can tell you stories about just this history with the Seattle Police Department of being treated disrespectfully and with excessive force. And I mean, there's all sorts of really ugly stories that one hears. The Williams family had long experienced that, but what Rick Williams and his family told me is that it had stepped up dramatically after the shooting. They were being followed. The police are, like I said, kept coming up to him to supposedly offer condolences, and the condolences would end up with, well, he wouldn't have been shot if he dropped the knife, and so on. And his three teenage sons as well, which is, you know, particularly troubling to myself.
What is the status of Native Americans in Seattle society? What's the status of Native Americans in Seattle society?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question?
What's the status of Native Americans in Seattle society? What is their standing? How are they treated by the rest of the population? How would you characterize it?
Well, it's kind of ironic since we live in a city that's named after Chief Seattle. There is a significant population of Natives in Seattle, and I wish I knew offhand the number, but I, of course, being a part of this community, think that we're visible, but I know that that's not always true. You know, the Northwest is the location of a lot of historic treaty rights battles. For instance, the fishing struggles, the fishing wars of the 70s happened here, and so I think of this as a place where lots of strong, proactive, politically aware Natives live, and hang on one sec. Pardon me. I tend to think that we have good relationships with non-Natives in the city, and Seattle is surrounded by a number of prosperous and politically active tribes like the Tulalip and Muckleshoot, who are economic forces and contribute a great deal economically to the area with their casinos and with charitable donations. So I think of this place, I mean, you know, it's not South Dakota. I always think of the Northwest as being more progressive in its relationship with Natives. Mm-hmm. But this has been kind of eye-opening for me to, if you read the comment sections in the newspaper, for instance, any of the articles on this shooting, you get to hear more, get to read more of the racism that is kind of lurking under the surface. And I guess another thing about the Northwest is this is such a, you know, overall a politically progressive place with kind of a warm and fuzzy West Coast vibe. So the racism that you might see more blatantly in, say, South Dakota is more hidden here. And this is, it's been a little unsettling to be exposed to some of that racism that is there, that's maybe more hidden here in Seattle.
Is there?
I should also say that at the same time, on the other hand, that there have been lots of non-Native folks who are really distressed by this and who are stepping forward and wanting to add their voices and their energies to bringing reform and accountability to the Seattle Police Department.
And that was my next question. What do those numbers look like?
The numbers of?
Of supporters of your movement.
That's a good question, and we'll see as things evolve. So far, there have been lots of other organizations in town, such as El Centro de la Raza, which is kind of the focus of the Latina community's activism, and Mothers for Police Accountability, which is run by Reverend Harriet Walden, who is from the African American community and has been organizing around police accountability issues for a very long time in that community. But all of these folks are concerned and wanting to take the awareness that is growing in Washington right now about this issue, about the issue of police relationships with, I was going to say communities of color, but it's, even though it is primarily communities of color, it's not just non-white folks who experience police misconduct. It's I'm meeting all sorts of people these days who want to tell me their stories, and it's not all non-white folks. But as to what kind of numbers we're looking at, that's impossible to say, but there are a lot of outraged taxpayers who do not like their money supporting so-called public servants who shoot people.
I want to know, when did, and we have just a few more minutes, when do you know the history of the Firearm Review Board, and also when did police cars in Seattle start being able to capture the activity of cops on video?
That's a good question. I can't remember exactly when the car cameras started, but it hasn't been terribly long, just a few years. And the Chief Diaz has actually stated that he is planning to institute a pilot program testing the body cameras. I believe 40 officers will be wearing those. I'm not exactly sure when that's going to start, but
In regards to the car cameras, are you aware that it came out of any particular push by a certain group? Like, is there a strong cop watch group out there?
There are people who have been organizing around this issue for years. I would say that Reverend Harriet Walden of Mothers for Police Accountability is responsible for a lot of the. I know she's responsible for the fact that the officers carry tasers. And I know that it was activism on the part of citizens that did lead to the cameras on the cars. So you can be heartened looking at the history of citizen accountability efforts in Seattle, and knowing that it can lead someplace positive. Mm-hmm. It's just slow and torturous progress, a process, and obviously it happens on the bodies of people who are victims of excessive force.
Mm-hmm. And what about the Firearm Review Board?
I cannot tell you about the history of the Firearms Review Board. I'm not real clear on exactly when that started. Sorry about that.
Okay. Well, January 10th, this coming Monday, is the inquest into the John Williams killing. And I'm hoping to get an update from you after that happens. And thank you so much, Fern Renville, for this interview.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. At our pre-inquest community summit, Rick Williams, the brother of John T., got up and spoke to the audience, and he has been incredibly composed and calm through this whole ordeal, and he spoke very movingly to the audience about the importance of everyone who comes to the inquest attending in a really respectful and quiet and dignified way to bear witness and to not contribute to stereotypes of Indians as being violent, which is one of the labels that was attached to his brother.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks a lot, Fern. We'll be right back. On January 12, 2010, Jordan Miles, an 18-year-old senior at Kappa High School in Pittsburgh, where he was an honor student, was beaten up by police as he walked to his grandmother's house. Over the course of the attack, he was repeatedly punched in the face, he was hit with a tree branch, and patches of his neat locks were pulled from his hair, according to Brandy Fisher of the Justice for Jordan Miles campaign and the Alliance for Police Accountability. According to a statement published by Jordan Miles' family and posted on the Justice for Jordan Miles campaign website, the police officers jumped out of their car near Miles, yelling, "Where's the gun? Where's the money? Where's the drugs?" Because the officers were in plain clothes and their car was unmarked, Miles did not immediately assume that they were cops. Instead, he thought he was being robbed and began to run. When the cops overtook him, he was beaten, arrested, and subsequently charged with 2 counts of aggravated assault, loitering and prowling at nighttime, escape, and resisting arrest. Although all charges were subsequently thrown out, his face was badly swollen, he deals with permanent nerve damage, and according to Brandy Fisher, he still struggles emotionally as a result of what happened that night. The one-year anniversary of his brutalization by police will be marked by a vigil at 7 p.m. at the site of the police attack, which was Tioga and Rosedale Street in Pittsburgh. We speak with Brandy Fisher of the Alliance for Police Accountability about the case. We're talking with Sister Brandy Fisher of the Alliance for Police Accountability out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She and the organization have been working around the Jordan Miles case. Jordan Miles was a victim of police brutality on January 12, 2010, a day or so after his birthday. Can you talk a little bit more about Jordan Miles's the attack that he had to deal with?
Jordan had just turned 18 at the time. And his mother and his grandmother live approximately 3 blocks away from each other. And he stays over his grandmother's most nights. So this night he left his mother's home and was on his way to his grandmother's. He walked approximately 3 houses up from his own residence and before he was jumped out on by what he saw as 3 people. It was an unmarked vehicle. They were in plain clothes. These were undercover police officers. Of course, he had no clue at the time. They jumped out and they yelled, "Where are the drugs? Where's the money?" And he thought he was being robbed. He thought someone was trying to rob him, so he immediately turned to run. It was January here in Pittsburgh. It was very cold, snowy outside. So he slipped as soon as he turned to run. And as he slipped and fell, the police attacked him. Their reasoning is that they thought he had a gun, which then they said was a Mountain Dew bottle.
But why did they think he had a gun? Did they say he was carrying that Mountain Dew bottle in his hand?
No, it was supposed to be in a coat pocket. They seen something heavy in a coat pocket. Mm-hmm. So he's walking, what they call lurking, suspiciously lurking between houses. But he's walking up the street, you know, from his house. And they said they seen something heavy in his coat pocket, which they claimed turned out to be a Mountain Dew bottle, which has never been turned up at all. Mm-hmm. No one's ever found this Mountain Dew bottle. And, of course, Jordan says he's never had one. So, you know, the truth is that they just seen him walking. Homewood is a fairly high crime-ridden area, predominantly African-American and of the lower income status. And so they just saw him, you know, a young black male walking in Homewood at night and assumed he would have to be involved in some type of crime. And usually they may come out to be right, and that's why they do this. You know, they'll find probably something on someone, even if someone just uses drugs. You find something on them. So, you know, when that happens to people, they don't make a complaint because they feel like they're already in a wrong. You know, okay, I had a small amount of marijuana on me. I did something wrong. But it doesn't give the police the right to just brutalize people. I mean, he's already on the ground once they get to him because he fell. They beat him with a tree branch. They repeatedly punched him in his face. His face was extremely swollen. He has permanent nerve damage in one side of his face. They made him keep his face down in the snow. They stripped him of his coat. It was freezing outside, and they would not let him move. Anytime he moved to get comfortable, they would beat him. and said, "We told you not to move." He began to pray because his grandmother, he's been raised, you know, to call on God when in a case where, you know, something's so wrong, and he felt like he was going to die. Those are his words. He said he felt like he was going to die. And so he was saying the Lord's Prayer, trying to recite it. Every time he recited the Lord's Prayer, they punched him in his face. "Didn't I tell you to shut up?" So he would recite it again. They punched him in his face. "Didn't I tell you to shut up?" And not ever did they allow him to lift his face out of the snow at all. So, you know, you have this young man who was a high honor student. He goes to a performing arts school, has never even been in a fight in his life, very mild-mannered, plays the viola, very quiet, who is brutalized in the middle of the night, thinking he's going to die.
And how long was he face down in the snow?
I don't have the exact time, but I know, you know, from the accounts that his mother has given me, it was longer than 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was out there for quite some time before they would put him in the car. And, you know, the case itself, you know, is horrific because they stated that he was lurking, you know, behind a neighbor's house, you know, and that the neighbor, I guess, was supposed to have made a complaint. The reason why they charged Jordan Miles with several charges, resisting arrest, you know, assault, I think, on a police officer, because they said he kicked one of the police officers. And so when he went to court, all the charges were dismissed. One, there was no Mountain Dew bottle. Two, the neighbor that they claimed said they talked to her, and she said she didn't know who Jordan was. Said they never asked her a question. She knows Jordan very well and his family, so she would have never said that. So they blatantly lied. And they perjured themselves, and it was, and that is why the judge dropped the charges against him.
Wait, they had said that she didn't know who Jordan was, but she was complaining about somebody who fit that description lurking around.
Right. They said that they had asked her, "Do you know this young man?" They said he was lurking in an area between houses, and when they got him, they claimed that the neighbor was in the window, and they asked her, "Do you know this young man?" And she said no. And she was in the window. She said she asked them what was going on. But she said they had never showed her Jordan, never asked her if she knew him, and she never complained about anyone being around her house. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they blatantly lied in court. And, you know, she rebutted. And she said because she knows she knows him.
And so she testified in that trial.
Yes, she did. And that is why his charges were dismissed.
Uh-huh. And so he's saying that, so they're lying about whether or not the neighbor knew her, knew him, and what, and the fact that they had asked her questions. And they're also, according to Jordan himself, about the Mountain Dew bottle, he said he was never carrying a Mountain Dew bottle. He definitely didn't have a gun. I wanted to go back to that. Let me just ask you. So all these lies, but it made it through. Made it past the trial, made it past the case, made it past the preliminary stages, right?
No, it was at the preliminary hearing that the charges were dropped. And it's funny because the police officers were supposed to be so upset that these charges were dismissed against him. St. Patrick's Day parade, the Fraternal Order of Police and marched in St. Patrick's Day parade with T-shirts supporting the three officers. Mm-hmm. You know, in response to that, they also had this rumor of what they called blue flu that was going to happen, which was all the police officers were going to stop patrolling Homewood as much and as regular in response and to reaction to the charges being dismissed against Jordan Miles.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, there was something else about that night too that was disturbing to me and to other people who heard about his case. So you talked about how he was beaten. He was praying on the ground and he was beaten. He was beaten with a tree branch, but they pulled his hair out as well, right?
Yes, they did. They he wears locks, dreadlocks in his hair, and they were very long. I would probably say maybe about a foot long each, you know, and a whole side of his head, they ripped his hair out of his head. They claimed that he fell into bushes and the bushes ripped his hair out, which would have to be virtually impossible because it was an entire patch ripped from the roots. And you could see, you know, where they were just tore out of his head. I mean, and it has to be excruciating painful. I mean, you can take one strand of hair and pull it, and you feel that. But to have the whole side of your head just ripped out by hand, that is brutal force. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot to just rip hair from the roots, and especially thick dreadlocks. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot to rip them out of your head. And so, you know, to have this young boy in the middle of the night walking from his home to his grandmother's, as he usually does, and to encounter such a brutal attack, how do you explain that? How do you explain to the mother? How do you explain to the community? How do you explain to the other children that this won't happen to you? You know, you raise your child the right way. You're paying for him to go to a performing arts school. He plays the viola. He's a high honor roll student. You're raising him in the faith that you believe in, and he's doing everything right. How do you convince someone that this is not going to happen to them? Because if you allow this to happen, then the community loses faith in the system. Then the gap and the divide between the community and the police officers widens even further than what it already is. Then the mistrust continues. And then so does a lot of the crime and the people getting away with it, because no one's going to feel free or feel comfortable coming forward to someone they look to as an enemy. I'm supposed to believe you're going to protect me, but I'm scared of you. Mm-hmm. How do you get children to understand why this happens and why the city does not care? It's difficult. And so what we at the Alliance for Police Accountability are trying to do is several things. But one is to have these three officers prosecuted. They're investigating. right now it's under a federal investigation. And they state that they don't feel that they have enough evidence to get a conviction.
Now, did the FBI do that on their own, decide to investigate, or were there people pushing them to do that?
Well, I'm sure they felt pushed to do it just because of what happened. So I don't know what prompted them to pick it up, but they did an investigation. It's supposed to be a civil rights violation investigation from the Department of Justice. And our very own DA Zapala, Stephen Zapala, we went down there and we marched down there. We took 1,000 signatures on petitions to have these police officers prosecuted. And we were told that they cannot conduct a simultaneous investigation while the FBI is conducting an investigation. They stated that's their policy. They are able to. The DA can prosecute tomorrow. But their policy is to wait until the federal investigation is complete. Our concern is that they're waiting to use the federal, the results of the federal investigation as an excuse not to prosecute. They're waiting for the feds to say, well, there's not enough evidence. But their burden of proof is a lot more strict than the state's would be. So because you can't get an eviction conviction in the federal case doesn't mean you wouldn't get one in the state case. But the Alliance's position is that regardless if you think you're going to win or lose, for DA Stephen Zapala to file charges against these three officers, it tells the community that he's not going to stand for this type of behavior. It tells the community that he is going to hold the police accountable when they think and act as if they're above the law. It tells the community that we want to work with you, that we're not against you, that we care about you. And it restores a hope to the community that police officers won't get away with this, so they'll come forward more and be willing to talk more about their own cases of police brutality, but also about criminal activity in their neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's a very clear message. You know, sometimes you have to, you know, stand on what is right, whether you think you're going to get a conviction or not. I mean, they don't do that with criminals. They didn't say, we're not going to charge Jordan Miles because we don't think we can get a conviction. That is what trial's for. That's what the court of law is for. You don't decide the case before you try it. You decide if there very well was a crime. Mm-hmm. And there was. The police perjured themselves at the preliminary hearing. The police are clearly lying when they say, we've seen something heavy in his pocket and his pockets are empty. They're clearly lying when they say, this woman said she doesn't know this young man and he's on the side of her home. And that's his neighbor and she's known him for many years. You know, so why lie if you're not in the wrong? Obviously, they have something to hide. And, you know, there's three grown men who train other officers on how to conduct themselves in this type of situation.
So these three officers that beat up Jordan Miles, they train other officers. I didn't know that.
Yes, at least two of them. Mm-hmm. Train other police officers on how to conduct themselves in these type of situations. So they know how to conduct themselves. And if three police officers whose weight is more than 600 pounds between the three of them cannot subdue a 150-pound 17-year-old boy, then without ripping his hair out of his head, without brutally beating him, without causing permanent nerve damage in his face, and these are the ones that we are trusting to train the other officers, then I think we're in a very sad situation.
Help me understand what you guys are actually going ahead. The family is going ahead and filing a civil suit against the Pittsburgh Police Department. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, there is a group of lawyers who, on the family's behalf, have filed a civil suit against the three police officers themselves and the city of Pittsburgh also. They're right now in mediation, which is a process that every civil suit has to go through. You have to agree to mediate. So they'll go through mediation, and if they can't come to some type of agreement or settlement, then it goes to trial. They go to mediation, of course, to try to save money of having a trial and going through all of that. So if they can't come to an agreement in mediation, then they will go ahead to trial. Now, this is just a civil suit. It has nothing to do with the criminal charges. And for the city to be, you know, willing to settle, you know, tells me a lot right there. You know, you're willing to settle in a case that you feel there was no wrongdoing in. So
help me understand this. They could decide, it's one of the options, the mediation. You can either go through a mediation process or you could actually go to trial. And both parties are asked if they want to do that. And both parties agreed to go through mediation. Is that correct? They're asked by the state if they want to, or the city, if they want to go through a mediation process.
It's a part of the process.
You have to go through
some sort of mediation. You can go through arbitration. You can choose what type of mediation, but you have to have some type of mediation. And it gives them a guarantee that they can say, well, we attempted to settle this, but we couldn't come to an agreement before it actually went to trial. We did attempt to settle this.
And what makes you think that the city is actually willing to come to a settlement?
It saves the money.
I mean, did they actually say that they're willing to settle?
Well, no, that's why the rule is there, you know, because it's better for the city to try to settle than to go through a trial. But they're hoping to come to an agreement, or they wouldn't be in mediation. Mm-hmm. You know, they're hoping to come to an agreement. As far as where, you know, the mother stands, when I talked to Ms. Miles about that, she says, you know, she can care less about what happens in mediation. She has put, and her family has put all their trust in God. They're praying that, you know, what is supposed to happen is going to happen. The mediation, the outcome of the trial and the mediation in the civil case, she said, has nothing to do with stopping police brutality. It's not going to solve the problem so that there is not another Jordan Miles. It's not so much her concern solely just about her son. She has a very unselfish attitude about the entire thing. She doesn't want this to happen to another child. She's hoping that her son's case can help that to occur. So that is why she has been very willing. She has allowed us to plaster her son's battered, beaten face all over the city. You know, and I know it's a painful reminder for her and her family every time they see it. But she has allowed it. She allows us, you know, to have the freedom to have these interviews because I speak with her. One thing I always do is I call her about anything, you know, because this is her child. You know, that's her baby. And you have to respect her position. And I wouldn't want, you know, even though I would be appreciative of any group's effort to help bring justice in this case, I just wouldn't want a whole lot of things going on in my son's name, and I'm just not aware of it. Mm-hmm. And so we respectfully send her, you know, anything that we're about to do, get her approval and her input. So she has been very active in this fight from where she sits.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go back to both the criminal investigation and then the civil suit. So we're waiting on, you guys are waiting on the results of the investigation in order to learn whether or not criminal charges are going to be filed against the Pittsburgh Police Department or against those particular officers. But is that, you have to wait on that? It's not like a citizen can come forth and file a complaint and say, I want charges filed against these police officers for these reasons, criminal charges.
Right. Because they're police officers, we are saying, all of us, citizens, in every rally and march we've had, the family is saying and has said on the news. They've been a part of our rallies. The sister has written a letter and spoken and have requested and demanded that charges be brought against the three officers. But because they are police officers, they have a different procedure. And, you know, if someone said I broke into their home, I would get arrested. They would ask questions later. My guilt or innocence would have to be proven in the court of law. It seems that the police have a procedure where they do an investigation to see if they can file charges, which, you know, is a little different than what us citizens have to go through. And it's interesting, the process that they're allowed to have. And it's indicative of the attitude that they have that they're above the law, mm-hmm. you know, because they don't have to go through the same, you know, process that we do if they do break the law, you know. And, you know, I like to make it very clear that the Alliance for Police Accountability is not against police officers. You know, we don't hate police. We know we need them. I wouldn't want to live in a world without them. I know they have a very difficult job. I wouldn't want to be one. But as any position that you hold, you have to be accountable for your actions. And because there is a higher regard, because someone gets more time for assaulting a police officer, because as we see the police officers have a special procedure if they break the law, then they should be held at a higher regard and a higher standard when they do break the law. And because they are sworn in and we pay them to protect us. You know, we are paying them to protect us and they are brutalizing our children and getting away with it. There's a question about it. If it was any other three men who did this to Jordan Miles, there would be no question about there being criminal activity. But because these three men wear badges, there's a question. Mm-hmm. There's a process. And here we are almost a whole year later, and nothing has happened. Mm-hmm. Jordan Miles has been affected emotionally. He could not even get through college. You know, this honor student couldn't even get through college. His mother has painstakingly told me that her son is a different person. She does not know her son sometimes. So this has affected him. It's been a very traumatic experience for him. He thought he was going to die. You know, to be in that position, laying in a cold, being beaten half to death, and praying for your life, and being beaten half to death, your hair is being ripped out, and you're this young kid. That has to be traumatic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is what, you know, people are not thinking about, the effects of it on this young man. And these police officers could easily have handcuffed him, and he'd been no problem. They could have easily sat on his back, and there had been no problem. They chose to beat him. They wanted to beat him. And the question is why? Why and what in your mind triggers you to want to treat another human being like this? And so that is why people raise the issue of race. All three officers were white. So do we want our communities, the officers patrolling our communities, to be more reflective of the community? I think so. Do we call in an issue of race? I think so, because it seems hateful. You know, why do you look at him as not your own child? Mm-hmm. Why do you look at him as inhumane that you can beat him to death like this or almost to death? You know, why is there, you know, not attempted murder charges even thought about? Because why would somebody even say that? How could you say the mind state of a person? But what do you think is going to be the end result of such brutality? So there's many questions to be answered in this case. And one question that the Alliance for Police Accountability asks is, why has there not yet been charges filed against not one of the three officers involved? Even if one stood by and the other two were more accountable, why is there not charges for not even one of the police officers when they clearly lied? And transcripts show that. You know, if the police officer is saying they had evidence of something and there's no evidence of it, then why are they not being questioned about that? You know, and so I don't think, you know, the federal investigation or the Department of Justice is saying that they don't think there was any wrongdoing. They just are not going to spend, you know, thousands of dollars and don't think they can get a conviction because they have a very high burden of proof. But DA Zappala needs to, our own DA here in Pittsburgh needs to step up and file charges on his three officers. The U.S. Attorney General, a member of our alliance, along with several of the activists in the Pittsburgh area, just had a meeting with the U.S. Attorney General. The U.S. Attorney General's office has now assigned a team of five lawyers. They have a new civil rights department who will, it'll be their job solely to prosecute or to get prosecution in these type of cases. And so they called this meeting with several activists in the area, unveiled, you know, what this new department in the U.S. Attorney General's office is going to be. We wrote a letter, which I've brought for you to keep, to the Attorney General. And, you know, he's made aware of this situation. And his response is right now it's an open case, so he can't really make comment on it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, since the Bush administration was in, civil rights violations weren't even to be investigated so much so by the Attorney General's office. But now that the Obama administration is in, they have this new group that they're allowed to have. Mm-hmm. And so it makes me hopeful. You know, that is just their job. Their mere focus is just on this. And it's just for Pittsburgh, you know, and we need it. And just to see that that has been formed shows that we need it. Mm-hmm. Just to see that it has been brought to Pittsburgh shows that someone hears us, you know. So it helps me keep going and, you know, and encouraging our members that even though we don't see the immediate effects, we are being heard, and we're getting attention. And I have, you know, vowed to the family that we will not stop until we have found justice for Jordan. And we will continue. You know, we started out of the Jordan Miles case, but we will continue to put forth this effort, and we will be working closely. One of our members, Kenneth Miller, is arranging a meeting between the Alliance and that five-member attorney team that the U.S. Attorney General just put together so we can sit down and talk about this particular case. Mm-hmm. So we are making every effort to move forward. And, you know, we're saying, hey, DA Zappala, if you don't want to do anything, we'll go above your head because we're going to get something done about this because it's too blatant. And there's too many people hurting, too many children that I've talked to personally hurting. And a lot of children have been a part of all of our rallies and marches, you know, and it's great to see the support, but it's sad for them to be hopeless. You know, and we don't want them disrespectful to police officers when they see them because they're harboring anger. You know, we don't want them to hate police officers. We want more of them to become police officers. You know, we need to stop this so more African Americans can be represented in this institution of police officers. Mm-hmm. And so if we, you know, if they keep looking at police officers like they're taboo, you know, that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's a domino effect just with this one thing, with this, with allowing this to continue, that goes deeper than just money and politics, you know. And I'm hoping that the city recognizes that it's about the community relations with the police officers, you know, as a whole. Mm-hmm. It's about, you know, you can promote racism this way because it's three white police officers against this one young black boy. And so people can see that as just, oh, police officers are racist. You know, we need to really show that they are going to be held accountable when they step outside of their job. Teachers are held accountable. Doctors are held accountable. They have malpractice suits. I mean, everybody's held accountable. Why are police officers above the law? Mm-hmm. You know, it makes no sense. And to me, they should be held at a higher standard than anyone else because they know the law better than anyone else, and they are paid to enforce that law. You're breaking the same law that you're paid to enforce. It makes no sense to, you know, even be allowed to happen.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask about, you started talking a little bit about how Jordan is doing, how he's holding up. You said he started January of last year. He had the attack. And then in September, he started college. Did he finish his first year of college?
No, he actually went to college in August. His mom drove him up. She was very excited. I talked to her on the phone when they were on the road. And he stayed there maybe about a month and a half, 2 months, and he just couldn't deal with the environment. She said she think it was him being away from home. It was also, you know, a lot of the masses of being in a massive crowd of people that he didn't know. So he was, and she had concerns when he was going anyway because she didn't want the media to just follow him and go to his school and you know, to just be able to question him because that's how much he was not dealing with this very well. Mm-hmm. But he didn't make it, and he came back home. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're hoping that, you know, through counseling, because he has been in counseling, and, you know, and they're hoping through prayer and believing through prayer that, you know, he will recover from this in a way where he can be productive and successful again. You know, it's just sad, though, because, you know, he's very intelligent, you know, full of artistic abilities, and an exceptional viola player, you know, and for a young, you know, African American male to be a high honor student, you know, I mean, that's an accomplishment for a single mother, you know, and living in Homewood, and for this to still happen, it makes you say, why, you know, I've done everything right, you know, and so that's why, you know, the community has rallied behind her. And rally behind him because we're tired. And if we allow this to keep happening, you know, it's not going to do anything but getting worse. It's going to go from beatings to deaths, you know. Mm-hmm. And we've already been there with deaths. You know, you have Johnny Gamage, who was killed years ago, and nothing was done. The police officers were let off. And, you know, so Pittsburgh is scarred with a lot of brutality attacks and the police getting away with it. It's like it's a police state here. Mm-hmm. in Pennsylvania. And we just need to know that our police officers are going to be held accountable and we don't have to live in fear in our own communities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as long as I'm here and Alliance for Police Accountability is here, we're going to make sure that that happens the best that we can. We're rewriting legislation right now, working with the city council. To get laws changed. We're writing laws with a group called BPEP, which Tim Stevens heads, is the Black Political Empowerment Project. And they're one of our alliances, the Black and White Reunion, Penn. And so we've teamed up with a lot of different organizations in Pittsburgh. And so that is one of the major goals I have, is to bring all of our efforts. Everyone has their own organization. Everyone's doing their own effort against the same fight, and us coming together, you know, would make the fight even stronger, but also make our position stronger. And if we can come together and get these things done, then I think we can, you know, be more impactful. And that's what I'm starting to see. Where, you know, you come out in more numbers, you have people who may be more in writing legislation, and you have more people who are better in doing action. So we all come together, you know, and for the same fight. And we're all down at city council, and we're all down at the mayor's office, and we're letting them know we're not going for this. Then, you know, that is what I think will make a difference. But as long as everyone is worried about, you know, who funds them, everybody's worried about, you know, their grant money, everybody's worried about having this politician in their pocket, then the people will never be served. You know, the people need to be first. And that's what the Alliance for Police Accountability is for. We're for the people. Mm-hmm. And that's why we didn't just jump on one of these organizations that already exist, because we're for the people. And we're not being funded by anyone. No one is keeping our mouth shut, mm-hmm. Or controls what we say. We're saying we want prosecution. We're saying we demand prosecution. We're saying we're tired of racial profiling. That is a crime, and these young people shouldn't have to deal with it. You should be allowed to walk with your friends from one person's house to the next in a home in the area that you grew up in. These children don't choose to be raised in these areas. You know, they don't have a choice. And so they shouldn't have to live in fear and say, oh, no, we can't. Let's not go to Chrissy's house because there's four of us. Why? Why not? Why shouldn't you be allowed to walk four people in a group down the street? Why should you say no because we're afraid because, you know, the police might think we're doing something? They shouldn't have to think that way. And this is really what goes on. And so, you know, we're trying to stop that, you know, from being a problem. And we want these children to be safe, you know, and that's what it is. It's our kids. Mm-hmm. It's our kids. And, yes, we have a very real problem out here. We have these drugs out here. We have low socioeconomic statuses going on. We have killings going on. And, yes, they are being done by some of these very same young people. But it is all connected. And we have to start the healing process somewhere. And it definitely needs to start with the law, because the more that we can work with them, the more that we can build a positive relationship, the more we can get them back into the schools talking to these kids, the more we can have them walking up and down the streets. You know, the thing is really caring. And these children feel like no one cares. And, you know, if the police show that they really care about the community, and instead of being the enemy of the community, I think we would get further ahead. And the mayor and the DA is responsible for ensuring that that occurs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So I'm wondering if you can give me the names of those officers who beat Jordan Miles.
Was Officer Richard Ewing, David Sisak, and Michael Salduet.
Okay. And I know that there's something being planned. Well, first of all, can you tell me about the engagement of the community in this organization that you guys started up in the wake of Miles' attack? How many people come out to meetings? Is it a large outpouring of folks coming to these meetings?
Well, our meetings, of course, no. The meetings is where all the work is done. You never really have too many workers when it comes to doing things. But, you know, and we're really not looking for too many workers. I mean, we do need some, you know, and we do need more right now. But we really need people to be there when it's time to show up for support, when the numbers matter, mm-hmm. you know, because everyone has their own life. And there's a few of us that don't mind just making sacrificial efforts as long as we can get the work done. But our meetings consist of maybe about 20 people per meeting. Mm-hmm. We have a Google group, though, which has about 500 maybe people who are part of that list. These are people who have come out to our rallies, people in different organizations who have showed an interest, and we add them to our list because that is where we put all of our information at. We can ask a question and get some answers. So between organizations and people, there's several, about 500 people in there. We also have a website. It's www.justiceforjordanmiles.com. This is our first campaign. The Alliance for Police Accountability, this is our Justice for Jordan Miles campaign. So here's our first campaign. We hope not to have many more. We're sure there will be another one. But so, you know, we're not going to stop here. You know, this wasn't just about Jordan Miles. He just was the momentum. He just got people, you know, fed up. And see, myself, I've always, you know, in college I've learned a lot. about, you know, what really happens in politics, what really happens in our communities. And I grew up in the inner city myself. I've seen it firsthand, and it's always been a passion of mine. I know a lot of people who are incarcerated. I hear their stories all the time. I remember I used to correspond with a young man, and he was put in a hole, and he was telling me there's this guy next to him that was in solitary confinement, and they call it the hole. And the police would just come down there and beat them. They would just come in their gear and just run in the room and just beat them and beat them and beat them. And he would not be given food. And I would say, why don't you report it? Why don't you say something? And he said, because then that will be me next. And it's sad, you know. And so I've always had a passion for injustice, to fight against it. And now that my children are old enough and I look at Jordan Miles, my son is 16 years old, and I just said, I could be my baby. And I don't know what I would do, you know? And so I feel that pain of his mother, and I feel the pain of all the mothers who have to go through this, you know, and are not educated on, you know, they think they have to have money to fight against this. You know, they think they have to have money to get a lawyer to fight against this. And so, you know, one of our missions is to educate the people. We had a teach-in that on October 22nd that marked the National Day of Police Brutality, against police brutality. And we taught people how to fight against this. We had members of the ACLU there to show them, you know, you can fill out this application, you can make this complaint. You know, and then we have the Citizens Police Review Board here. And so we're teaching people that there are different organizations set in place for you to go to when things like this happen. And so they weren't aware of that. You know, there's a lot of things that they just don't have the knowledge of. And so if more people filed more complaints, if more people were more educated, and, you know, it aids in this being stopped. And we're hoping that it's just not, you know, the alliance or the community against police, but it becomes the a unified effort to fight against this problem. You know, and it's a shame because they have their own brotherhood, you know, within their institution, the police officers. Do they have their own, you know, stop snitching policy, you know? And so I've talked to, there's been a police officer, retired police officer, who has aligned himself with us, and the things that you know, he explained that, you know, they go through if they stand up against one of their brothers. It's looked at as being wrong, you know, because I asked myself, if we really, you know, want to believe in these police officers, why do they allow the other police officers to get away with this, mm-hmm. you know? And so, you know, it's this unspoken thing they have. And so it's a lot to go through. But the problem lies with the city. Because they're responsible to make the police officers act accordingly, you know, and so that is where our issue is taken up with. You know, they need to get their own departments together. But when these issues arise, what message are you sending to these police officers? You're telling them it's okay. They can do what they want. So why would they ever stop? Mm-hmm. Why would anyone ever stop? If you're not reprimanded for what you do, why would you stop? Mm-hmm. If it works and you get away with it, why would you stop? You know? And so they look at it. One out of the 30 people we stopped happened to be a good kid. You know, that's how they look at it. It happened to be somebody that, you know, we messed up with just one kid. But the people that we get after so many times that we do this, to them is worth it. You know, that's their mentality. Because that's their value on life. Or at least on our kids' lives anyway. They don't value them at all. Because there's not, if you thought he had a gun, he fell, he's on the ground. Grab him, handcuff him. There's three of you. Why was it necessary to beat him repeatedly, several times? Why was it necessary to do that? It wasn't. There is something called excessive force. There is something called police brutality. And it exists. And they need to be held accountable for that, mm-hmm. in some sort of way, and not just monetary. It's their job. You have a supervisor. You have a boss. You're supposed to have, your job is supposed to be done correctly. You did not do your job correctly. That's immediate termination. Why are they still getting paid? And more, than they were because they get paid for overtime that they would miss. You know, it's just unbelievable. They're being rewarded. They're not being punished. They got a free vacation. Their Christmas isn't messed up, but Jordan Miles' is. His whole life is. And so, you know, and I think about they need to be an example.
They were put on desk duty or something?
No, they're not on the streets. They were put on, they're suspended with pay. Mm-hmm. They were supposed to be suspended. They were put on desk duty and then working sporadically. It wasn't like they were, you know, but they have not been, they're now trying to put them back on the streets to see if that's an option. We definitely don't want that. They definitely don't need to be on the streets. And the thing about it is these same three police officers have a history. They have a history. It's not the first incident. You know, they say that they're decorated police officers, you know, and in our letter to the Attorney General's office, we asked them, investigate them. I guarantee you'll find a history. And see, when you see a history, then it needs to raise alarm, mm-hmm. you know, because then obviously this is made a habit, you know, and they're looked at as being decorated police officers because they have a high rate of retention, you know, of arrest, of, you know, getting guns off the streets, you know. But they also have complaints about planting guns. So did you plant that same gun that you just got the recommendation or the award for getting off the street? You know, so these are things that really need to be investigated, you know, and the more that we look into these police officers, the more that we find. And so, you know, the argument for at first was that these are decorated police officers. This was just one incident. You know, they received accommodations after this happened for some past act that they did that was heroic. And I feel like, you know, that was a slap in the face. It was, you know, distasteful. It would have been better for the city to wait. Why would you even award anyone? And then they televised it. These three officers, you know, getting awards. It's like taunting the community to me, you know, and a blatant we don't care. And so, you know, the city of Pittsburgh, you know, I don't know. I have not really compared too much to other cities, you know. I just think it is a mentality of police officers, you know. I know they do have a difficult job, but I think they have this mentality, you know, like they're soldiers in a war and the citizens that they're supposed to protect are the enemies. You know, everybody can't be a criminal. So, you know, when you get to mistaking people, that's because you're profiling people. If you see a crime, then you do something. But because you see someone walking in a neighborhood where that is high, that's normally a high crime area, okay, well, stop and ask somebody something. You don't just jump out on people and beat them. That's not a good procedure. So they need to change their procedures. They need to change their policies, and they need to rewrite these laws, but they also need to hold their police officers accountable for their actions by prosecuting them when they commit a crime.
Now, what's happening around January, around Martin Luther King's birthday?
Well, we are in process of having a day of action. You know, we haven't ironed all of the particulars out, but we know we will be doing some sort of protest. I personally would love to protest in front of police barracks where these three police officers work. But, you know, that idea is still up in the air. They want to have the Alliance would rather have a march in the area where it occurred. In Homewood, and we've already had one, you know, so I'm hoping we can do something that's more impactful, a little more radical, that sends a statement and something that's a little different that'll get people out to support even further. It's going to be cold. It's going to be very cold, but, you know, it doesn't stop, you know, and like Martin Luther King said, you know, things that happen to people directly, you know, affect a lot of other people indirectly. And so, you know, Jordan Miles, it happened to him directly, but it affected all of us. And so, you know, we're trying to send that message to the city and let them know it's not just him that is affected by this. We're all hurt by this. And the thing that I like best here, you know, people call Pittsburgh a racist city, but our turnouts have been very diverse, extremely diverse, multicultural. A lot of churches have stepped up and stepped out. You know, you see the intermix of ages. There's older people walking on canes in our marches, and then you have little babies and strollers. You have white people, you have black people, you have Asian people. You know, it was a mix, and it was wonderful that people care about this. And it's not just a black issue, mm-hmm. even though it happened to a black kid. You know, the issue of police brutality is not solely a racial issue, you know, because you have black police officers beating black people. You have white police officers beating white people, you know, and so it's a mentality. It's an institutional mentality that needs to be looked at and reexamined. And so these police officers, you know, it's like they're coming at it with this militant attitude, and they're in Iraq, and that's not how you're supposed to go through communities. You can't do that. You become a terrorist at that point. Mm-hmm. You're terrorizing our community, opposed to helping us. And I'm not paying anyone to terrorize my children.
I just want to thank you, Brandi Fisher, for the work that you're doing and the work that your organization is doing. Thank you so much for the interview, and I wish you guys lots of strength and lots of power in this movement. And hopefully you can collaborate with what folks are doing around police brutality in Philadelphia.
Yeah, we would love to. We would love to come out here. And, you know, you guys have a more of a your politics out here are a lot better than ours, I think. I think so. Yeah, you have more of a diverse set of politicians than we do. And so I think, you know, you guys, you know, even though I know you still have a fight, you know, you're growing and it's getting a lot better. So, you know, I would love for us to collaborate. We also have a summit. It's an annual summit against racism. That's going to be January 22nd. And one of the groups, the Black and White Reunion that we're aligned with, we've come together with them to do this annual summit against racism. So that's something else we have going on January 22nd, and I can give you guys updates about and send you information and maybe even pictures about how that turned out.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, we're going to continue in this, and I'm hopeful. I really am hopeful because in the beginning there was nothing being done. And, you know, we're struggling and funding this on our own. And, you know, at times you second guess yourself. And you wonder, is it worth it? But when you see, you know, the U.S. Attorney General talking about Jordan Miles, for his name to be even in his mouth, it's like, okay, it was worth it, you know.
He did that on television?
Yeah, he did. He made a statement. It was written in a paper. And he just said that, you know, right now I cannot comment about the Miles case. But it lets me know that it's on his mind. Mm-hmm. You know, it lets me know that he's looking at the Miles case. And I don't think that would have happened if we wouldn't have kept this, you know, on the forefront. And his mother is just so adamant about this. She wants this, you know, she's angry. I would be angry, you know, and we don't want her bitter. We don't want her hopeless. And, you know, and that's all she wants. She wants them to be held accountable, and she just wants this to stop. She doesn't want this to happen to another person. And so, you know, we as a collective effort are going to come together, everyone, you know, and Pittsburgh has been coming together. I will not deny it. We knocked literally door to door, knocked on doors and talked to people, told them about the actions that we were doing, invited them out. In the conversations that you have with people, people care, but people are hopeless. You know, you ask yourself, why are they not showing up at these rallies like we would like them to? Why isn't there 1,000 people here? Why is it just 300? But they think nothing's going to happen. Here's another march. What is this going to do? They don't think it's effective. And so I'm hoping that they learn that it's effective because we have, you know, the U.S. Attorney General's on it. They have made a new group focused on civil rights violations. And so, you know, if it wasn't worth it, then, you know, changes wouldn't be made. And so I just want to encourage people who are in the fight to not give up. And even though it seems like nothing is being done and you think they're just going to do what they want, do not give up because it does have an impact. It does have an impact.
So you guys contacted Holder's office. They didn't just come out on their own and contact you guys.
Well, we contacted Holder's office about Jordan Miles separately. This new formation of the group, I wouldn't say necessarily it was because we contacted them, but I know it has a lot to do with our rallies. It has a lot to do with the media attention that this case has gotten. It has a lot to do with the fight that I really believe that it has a lot, because it's for the city of Pittsburgh. And when you look at the city of Pittsburgh, how many incidents do you see? You know, there are a lot. They're just not brought forth. And so, and a reason is because it costs money. It does. It costs money. It costs money to have all these flyers printed up and to pass all these flyers out to people. It costs money to have a place to have these meetings. It costs time after you get off work to dedicate to this. And so I think people get tired, and I also think they're hopeful that people will get tired, mm-hmm. and it will just dissipate. It will just fade away, you know, but we're not. We're not going anywhere. The Alliance for Police Accountability is here to stay. And, you know, anybody that encounters a problem, we let them know, call us, and we will help you in any capacity that we can. You know, we're very careful about the cases that we take on, but we will lead people in the right direction if we can't help them ourselves, because it's going to stop. It's going, if it's 85%, it's going to go down to 70%, 55% until it's down to zero, because it has to stop.
Thanks for joining us for another edition of On the Block Radio on WPEB 88.1 FM, Philadelphia, Philly's only real community radio station.